You know, it's very easy for us to fashion Jesus in our own image, effectively making him who we want him to be rather than who he truly is. Some would make Jesus so loving and compassionate that he accepts everything and everyone and could never imagine the harsh words in Matthew 23 coming from their Jesus. Some would make Jesus so judgmental that Matthew 23 isn't the problem. It's the whole idea of Jesus being the friend of tax collectors and sinners. That's what doesn't fit into their mold of him. No, it's best for us to let Jesus be who he is, Lord and Savior, the one who does have a capacity to love and forgive far beyond just merely human means. We can never have the level of forgiveness or love that God would call us to outside of his power, outside of his spirit, outside of the character of his son. But also, him being able to say the hard things, the things that ultimately our sin nature needs to hear, how our humanness needs to be confronted by godliness and righteousness, Jesus as Lord making those statements. And I think Matthew 23 certainly represents that for us. But, you know, I really do think that what Jesus said in Matthew 22 last week really is more powerful and challenging than anything you'll say in Matthew 23. And because some of you were not here, and I think the fact that we can never contemplate it enough to continue to consider again what loving God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, what that really means. See, it should radically change everything, both what we do and how we do it. You know, when we think about the rubric that should be for every aspect of life, that this is a standard that we can have before us all the time. To what extent and what I'm doing, does that reflect a love for God? Am I loving God with all my heart, my soul, and my mind? I wonder what things would change. I wonder what things you would think of, even right now, would change in terms of the things you think, the things you do, your lack of regard for the word, or whatever it might be, in terms of how we would love God with all our hearts, our souls, and our mind. I think it confronts our mediocrity and the half-hearted way that we typically approach God and shows us what God is calling us to. And I think the people that we become and the blessings that we receive when we give God his proper place is really incredible. See, for me to think and realize just the kind of God we have, and when he comes to us and says, "Love me in this way," certainly it is sacrificial. It's transforming. We will be different people. We will be fighting against ourselves and dying to ourselves and denying ourselves, but all to receive from God something far greater than we could ever receive from ourselves. I mean, the promise we have in God's economy in terms of when we're surrendered to God, I mean, just looking at Romans 8:28, just being able to live your life with the knowledge that God works all things together for the good for those who love him and are called to his purpose. You know, I mean, oftentimes we see the first part of that verse and we just, you know, maybe get contented with, oh, God is working for all things together for the good. And we forget about the fact that it's for those who love him and are called to his purpose. See, because if you're not loving God, again, if you don't have that engaged relationship with God, you won't even understand the ways that God is working things together for your good. See, as I even pray for Christian Blanchette, who is my nephew, who I care deeply about, and really the only thing I can imagine that could be good about his situation is that God radically changes what's happening in his kidneys, and the fact that this kid would never have a kidney stone again in his life. But you know something? God's ways are higher than my ways. God's thoughts are higher than my thoughts. And even as we make that request to God, we lay it at his feet to say, you know something, how are you going to work this together for good? Is there something more beneficial to Christian, to his family, to his world, to the world, that he continues to have this? But again, if you don't love God, if you're not engaged in a relationship, see, it's very easy for God to disappoint us in that context. To say, God, why would you do that? Or why wouldn't you do that? See, but ultimately, as we love God in this way, again, the benefit that comes to us, even in that simple verse of knowing, having the peace, the joy that comes from knowing God works all things together for the good for those who love him and are called to his purpose. Well, if you recall, if you were here last week, that statement in Matthew 22 really flows from a tension-filled environment with Jesus and the Pharisees. They're pummeling him with questions, trying to trick him and ultimately help him, have him to answer away in a way that they would be able to confront him and challenge him. And basically, as we move into chapter 23, it's coming from that same context. Now, Jesus isn't responding to questions. He is not asking them questions. He is just blasting them. He is just ultimately before the people, directing the people in terms of, and his disciples more specifically, just what they should think about the Pharisees, how they should internalize them. And again, there's some hard statements that are there. But you know something? When you consider the things that Jesus addresses, we can understand why Jesus is so critical of them. Pride, leading people astray, hypocrisy, and legalism are all things that God hates. You know, ultimately, if we were to think about, again, the four general categories of what Jesus addresses here, that's it. It's pride, it's leading people astray, it's hypocrisy, and it's legalism. And I think Jesus is really expressing the heart of God in terms of how all of those are not part of his character, it's not part of his plan, and it's ultimately destructive to us. But let's get into our text, starting in verse 1 of Matthew 23. And it says here, "Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, 'The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must obey them and do everything they tell you, but do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. They tie up heavy loads and put them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them.'" Now, what is interesting is that before Jesus blasts the Pharisees, he actually honors them. And I think there's a very important principle for us in terms of our lives that's expressed here. Because I think we are pretty consistently finding what Jesus is saying here. Because what he's saying is that sometimes when we're engaging with people that are in authority, that have a place of responsibility over us, that when they're not doing things that are right, there's still a place for us to honor them because of the position that they hold or the good things that they say. I mean, how challenging it is for us at times to deal with who are the elected officials. When we look at different presidential candidates and we start imagining, oh my gosh, if this person is elected, what is that going to mean for me? What opinion do I have of them? But you know something, independent of any of that, whether you're dealing with a policeman, a teacher, the pastor, an elder, whatever it might be, even when people are doing bad things, what Jesus is saying is there's a place of respect to give them. Like these Pharisees, in the next 30-some-odd verses, I'm going to just, you know, blast them in terms of the things that I'm going to say about them. Seven woes where it's like, woe to you, Pharisees. You're like whited sepulchres. You're full of dead men's bones, but you have this outward appearance that looks good. But before he does that, he's saying, you know something, they still sit in the seat of Moses. They still have that place that God need, that the people of Israel need in terms of what God provided, in terms of someone speaking for God, someone speaking the word, instructing the people in his way. And even to the extent that they're saying the word of God, you should listen to them. But when they're not doing it, when they're not then applying the word in the way that God would intend, don't do that. Don't, Jesus is saying, don't think that I'm saying honor them in that way, but still give them honor for their position. Like I said, one of the four main things that Jesus is addressing here is legalism. And really, that's what comes up in verse 4 here. When Jesus says they tie up loads and put them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. Again, that when you think about or internalize that the responsibility from your relationship with God or your being accepted by God is placed on you, that's a very heavy burden. If you think God is a God that expects you to clean up your life and you to get it all right before he'll give you the time of day, that's a heavy burden to bear. And ultimately, that's what the Pharisees thought. They thought they were earning their way to God. They thought that they were doing good things that made them more pure to God and more pure than other people. And so ultimately, as they communicated to other people their teaching, that was a heavy burden for them to bear. See, when you're trying to approach God on that basis, when you're trying to make your relationship with God more about rules and regulations than it is about relationship, when you're engaging with God by your power rather than His power, when you're thinking that you're doing things for God in order to be accepted by Him rather than because you're accepted by Him, again, when you're approaching Him by flesh instead of spirit, again, that is what legalism is. And you know something, there's a tendency within each of us. I think I gave a message sometime in the summer that talked about the reason why we're attracted to legalism. The fact that there's a place that our pride, our flesh, wants to make it about rules. Give me the 10 things I'm supposed to do, God. Then it's well defined. My eyes can see it. I can accomplish that. I can actually control you, God. Because if you tell me there's 10 things to do, well, I'll do those 10 things. Then the rest of my time, I'll do whatever I want. You know, so there's an aspect of legalism that we are drawn to, but Jesus is saying, watch out for that. Realizes they're putting that burden on people. Again, that is not the pattern to follow. That's not the kind of person you should be. In fact, when he says here that when they put that burden on men and then they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move it, that ultimately what he's saying is these people, as they were putting a burden on people and people were struggling with that, they were having a hard time with it, that ultimately the Pharisees would just continue to put more on them. They wouldn't help them. They would actually hinder the process and make the load bigger. I mean, basically what Jesus says about himself in Matthew 11, verses 28 and 30, and I'll just read this to just encourage you in terms of the way that Jesus approaches this. He says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." See, I think Jesus would intend us to juxtapose those two thoughts. The whole thought of what legalism does to weigh us down and the burden we internalize in terms of the kind of people we become if we feel like that burden is ours to bear. But see, the reason why Jesus' yoke is easy is because He supports us in carrying it. I mean, we know that godliness, we know that God's will isn't about us doing what we want, but it is doing what He wants in His power. It is doing what He wants, again, like I said, because we're saved, because we're accepted, not in order to be accepted. And so kind of moving on, just trying to make through as much of this passage as we can today. Again, he addresses legalism in verse 4. He'll do it again in other verses. But the next thing he addresses is the pride and self-promotion that was in the Pharisees. And starting in verse 5, it says, "Everything they do is done for men to see. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels on their garments long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted in the marketplace and to have men call them rabbi. But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have only one master and you are all brothers. And do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one father and he is in heaven. Nor are you to be called teacher, for you have one teacher, the Christ. The greatest among you will be your servant, for whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted." You know, I do believe that this kind of pride is an essential part of legalism. See, the minute you think that, again, it's your efforts, it's what you're doing that's making yourself right with God, well, then what's a tendency with that? I would want people to notice that, right? In other words, if I'm serving God and I think this is the thing that's making Him move and again, it's making me right with God, well, why wouldn't I want other people to see me as well? Again, why wouldn't I make the issue around my service? See, I think we all understand the desire that comes from getting public recognition. You know, again, I hope we don't look at this statement and say, well, that's not my problem. I know someone that has this problem, but I don't have this problem. In fact, what I was wondering as I thought about this is even to the extent that manners would dictate that we'd act like this, right? If you ask like Miss Manners or Dear Abby or whatever, what's the right thing to do? When I come into a party, should I go to the head table and assume that my seat is here, or should I go in the back? And you know something, they would say, you know something, manners would say you go in the back. But you know something, the reason why those are the manners is probably because of Jesus. In other words, but for Jesus saying that, we would think the thing to do would be to take the high position. It would be when I walk in the room, why don't you notice me? You know, when Jesus talks about these phylacteries were little boxes where different verses of Scripture would be held, and they tie them to their arm, they tie them to their foreheads. It was actually in obedience to Deuteronomy chapter 6, where it says that meditate on the world day and night, carry it with you whenever you, wherever you go. And that was the means of them obeying that. But again, rather than doing that and making it about dedication to the Word or a conviction about God's standards, they made it about themselves. My phylactery is bigger than your phylactery, so I must be righteous, more righteous than you. And again, that's a type of public recognition. But see, again, I think when we talk about the self-centeredness that comes with public recognition, I think we're all aware of that temptation. Whenever you're doing something in the public eye, there's a temptation to make it about you. You're singing in worship, you're teaching Sunday school, you're helping an old lady across the street, whatever you might be doing. You have a new hairdo. You bought a new dress. Pants or whatever. You know, maybe think of the guys wouldn't think about this, but hopefully that's not chauvinistic. Men will not buy new clothes and say, well, are you going to notice me? No, like, I got my hair done. I changed the color of my hair, and no one noticed me. Men would never say that, right? But anyways, you see the point I'm making, though. It's about like, I'm doing something, and what I'm expecting is that I get noticed for that. What Jesus is saying is that's a bad tendency. You can know that God is never leading you in that direction. You know, in other words, when you walk in a room and you're thinking, okay, should I want public recognition? Should I want the highest position? Should I want people to think all well of me in terms of who I am? Again, those are the thoughts that Jesus would say, no, you take those thoughts captive. You don't encourage that kind of thinking in your mind, even though we're all tempted, because it is part of our pride. It is part of ourself. It is part of our flesh to want that. And I think what Jesus says in verse 12 really says it best, where he says here, for whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. See, because ultimately, whenever we are being prideful, we pit God against us. Did you hear that? Whenever we're being prideful, we pit God against us. God is always striving, when we're prideful, to beat that down. He makes war against the prideful. But the humble, what does he do to the humble? He gives grace. So when we're humble, we actually have God on our side trying to work on our behalf. And that's what he means when he says that if you exalt yourself, God's going to humble you. If you humble yourself, you give God the freedom to lift you up and exalt you. Because again, you don't make it about you, you make it about him. And I think the point about the titles that Jesus mentions here is we shouldn't seek those either. You know, in other words, when we think about, again, what are people calling me? What are people referring to me as? And he's looking at various titles that would be in their community, in their society, and say, don't worry about being called rabbi. Don't worry about being called teacher. Don't worry about being called father. And even if, in certain contexts, it's appropriate for us to have that title, just realize that what Jesus' point here is realize you're not the final one. See, this does not mean that you don't call your father, father. It doesn't mean that you don't have your children call you father. But what you understand in being the father is you're not the ultimate father. You're not the final father. That above you as father is the father. It's okay if you call me teacher. In fact, you know, the basis of what I would call myself in terms of my ministry as a pastor is based on the word that it says when Jesus is leaving the earth in Ephesians 4, he gave to the world pastors and teachers, apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors and teachers. And so there's a place where I would be encouraged to think of myself in those terms based on the gift of Christ, based on what God's will is. But again, if you call me teacher, I would never say I'm the final teacher. I'm the ultimate teacher. So again, even though Jesus is addressing them and saying, like in your world, in your context, don't strive for those. Don't need those titles. And now in a different context, if we have those titles, just realize, again, we don't define ourselves by that. We're not the end of that. We're not the final person in terms of that. And I think it still is true that we don't strive for that. We don't need that. You know, it's certainly more than appropriate for you to do something for someone and for people to say thank you. But you know something? If no one says thank you, it really shouldn't bother you. If you do some great work for someone and they're not saying, boy, you know, I really appreciate who you are, all the gifts and talents that you have, and I really appreciate the fact that you did this for me. If they don't do that, it shouldn't matter to you at all. Because again, what Jesus is expressing here is that because Jesus is Lord, because God is the Master, again, there's nothing that we pursue in this life that makes me more important than him. And so therefore, there's always a place of humility for us. Let me just tell you this, that I am more than appreciative of the leaders we have now and the leaders we have had at Living Hope, that they live that out. That ultimately we don't have anyone in terms of a person in leadership, whether it be leading a ministry or deacons or elders that are trying to create a fiefdom or looking for public recognition. We don't have any look at me people. And again, I know that I'm so appreciative of that. And I'm hoping that that is the thing that then translates into everyone here, that that's not what we're striving to be. Again, particularly based on what Jesus says here. And so now, basically what happens in verse 13 here is this is the first of the woes. This is where Jesus, again, maybe in more stringent terms, in more harsh terms, starts blasting the Pharisees in terms of their behavior. And let's see what the first two woes are. Focus on. It says, woe to you teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You shut the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. You yourselves don't enter, nor will you let those who are trying to. Woe to you teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as you. And I hope that you realize what tone that Jesus is saying this in. That he is not like, oh, but woe is you guys. And you know, you're hypocrites. No, I can imagine a booming and resounding voice. A voice that says, you know something, Pharisees? You need to be brought to task. You need to be confronted in the wrong that you are, the wrong that you become, the wrong that you directed people in. And that's what he's doing. But see what the emphasis of these verses is? The emphasis is that you have led people astray. You know, you think about the things that gets God mad. This is one of the things that we know particularly gets God mad. See, it's one thing for you to chart a wrong direction for you to believe a wrong standard for yourself, and make choices that bring destruction on you. But when you try to lead other people into something that's wrong, you say, follow me into the wrong, and you use your position, your authority, what God has gifted you to lead people astray. Yeah, that's when the Bible talks about millstones being tied around your neck as you're thrown into the sea. Again, that's how passionate God is about when you're in leadership, when you have responsibility for other people, the fact that you make sure that you're not only doing things for your sake, but for their sake as well. And again, addressing these Pharisees and saying, in terms of your activity, what you have done is, again, you have made it about yourself. And so therefore, when you're leading and following your direction, you're leading other people in that direction. See, when it says here in verse 13, you yourselves do not enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to. I mean, he's really talking about himself. I mean, since we understand that Jesus is the gate, he is the door, he is the way to enter the kingdom, the Pharisees not only aren't believing him, they're stopping other people from believing him. And that's what Jesus is addressing there. Now, I'm not sure how many of you have a verse 14, or how many of you have noticed that in NIV, it goes from verse 13 to verse 14, not to verse 15. There is no verse 14 in the NIV. And basically, for those of you who have that, it talks about the Pharisees stealing widows' houses, leading public prayers, and for that, God will be judgment for the pride expressed in those things. But basically, what people feel is that the earliest manuscripts don't have verse 14 in it. All right, in the Gospel of Matthew. And then the later manuscripts that do have it, put it in different places. All right, this is a little technical information for you people that care about this. If you don't, just give me 2 more minutes and I'll explain it for the people that really care about this. Okay, so basically the later manuscripts that have it, put it in different places, either before or after verse 13. And so therefore, what scholars believe is that it's actually what's called an interpolation, that ultimately as a scribe is writing down, they realize, wait a minute, you know, in the context of Jesus talking about the Pharisees in Mark chapter 12, verse 40, it says that there. And so what they probably did is took that verse from Mark 12, verse 40 and put it here. But in terms of Matthew's account, in terms of what Matthew has Jesus saying, now that context of Mark 12 is not the same discourse in terms of all these woes, but it is a portion of Scripture where, again, Jesus is addressing the Pharisees in negative terms, talking about their behavior and pronouncing judgment on them. I think he does say woe in it, but it's not a series of woes that are here in the Gospel of Matthew. So I do believe that in terms of what Matthew seeks to communicate does not include verse 14. But now, going into verse 15, now if you don't care about this stuff, come back to me. Now in verse 15, it says, you travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as you are. I mean, do you realize how biting that is for the Pharisees? You know how hard it is for them to hear that? Do you see how Jesus is choosing words that are not going to be nice and comfortable? Let me make sure that I say something easy so you can hear it and you can understand. And no, this is Jesus blast for to tell these Pharisees that they're actually making their disciples sons of hell. Again, is a statement that confronts them. But Jesus' point that he's making in terms of criticizing them for their behavior is what he's saying is that when you bring a convert, and again, you put these burdens on them, you share what your direction in terms of God's economy is. When they're a disciple of yours, they're not only doing what they're doing for the sake of God, they're also doing it for the sake of you. So as one commentator wrote, is that these disciples out-Pharisee the Pharisees. That they actually take the legalistic standards and the burden that the Pharisees have put on them and actually go worse and do more than what the Pharisees are doing. And again, that's what Jesus is talking about. And so moving on in verse 16, it says, woe to you blind guides! You say, if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath. You blind fools, which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? You also may say, if anyone swears by the altar, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift on it, he is bound by his oath. You blind men, which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it. And he who swears by the temple swears by it and by everyone who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by God's throne and by the one who sits on it. Again, when you find yourself to be a legalistic person and you are making life about the externals, You're making life about the appearance of things. I mean, do you realize the hubris that is being addressed here for the Pharisees to say, okay, you've got the temple and there's gold in the temple. What's more important to you, Pharisees, the gold or the temple? What did they say? It's the gold that's more important. You've got an altar where a sacrifice is placed. And, you know, there'll be big sacrifices and small sacrifices. What's more important on that altar, the sacrifice or the altar that it's on? What did they say? It's a sacrifice. In other words, it's external. That, you know something, if you're swearing on a bull that's being sacrificed, that's a really important, you know, oath that you're taking. But if it's just a dove or a pigeon, well, that's not really important. You know, if there's only a little bit of gold in that part of the... See, in other words, what they're showing is, again, their external orientation, that the value that comes to life is in the external thing, the appearance of things, what things look like. And you know something, really what is being addressed here, or what they're missing, is the whole principle of sanctification. You know, sanctification is that principle in Scripture that says when God declares something to be separate, when God declares something to be holy, that's what makes it holy. So in other words, the reason why the temple is holy is God said it was. It wasn't because of what materials were used. It's not like this is a really rich temple, so therefore it's sanctified. That's a really pretty altar, or that's a real good sacrifice, so therefore that altar sanctified. And you know something? Whatever God calls sanctified is sanctified. It doesn't matter the condition of that. You know, I talk about, you know, God sanctifying Mount Sinai. Now, I don't think Mount Sinai was particularly anything different about Mount Sinai. It wasn't a taller mountain. You know, the goats there didn't leap higher than the goats on Mount Horeb or wherever else God might lead the Israelites. But that's the mountain that God chose. That's the thing that's sanctified. Now, the beauty of that for us, though, as we saw in the book of Leviticus, is now God comes along and the only thing he declares to be sanctified in the church age is you and me. The only thing he declares to be sanctified are believers. It's not this building. It's not those chairs. This is not a holy place in terms of being sanctified. You know, you see kids running around or you spill food. Oh my gosh, I spill food in the sanctuary. You know, certainly for us to regard it and to have a regard of worship as we enter, all those things are fine, but just realize that there's nothing sanctified about this building. Where in the Old Testament, in that economy, there were a lot of things that were sanctified. Read the book of Leviticus, and it'll tell you all the things that are sanctified in terms of the people of Israel. But for us, we're the only ones. So therefore, what makes you holy? What makes you sanctified? What makes you separate and set apart for God's kingdom and for God's glory? It's not you who does that. It's God who does that and what he declares about you. You know, so now moving on and just getting to just as much of this as we can before we take communion is that Jesus moves on in verse 23. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, but you have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former. You blind guide, you strain at a gnat, but swallow a camel. You know, I guess we won't be able to get to just this whole principle of hypocrisy. You know, because I mean, ultimately, you know, when you think, again, when I talked about the four things that Jesus addresses here, that the things that we need to consider in our lives, what are we being tempted in terms of pride? What are we being tempted in terms of being a bad influence or directing people along the wrong path? What are we being directed or tempted by in terms of legalism? And then that fourth thing is hypocrisy. But then again, that's later in the chapter. But let me just finish with this as Jesus, again, addresses another aspect of legalism. Again, another aspect when, again, I think I'm earning my way to God. Again, that the focus of my life is the things that I'm doing. See, and the influence that that has on people's lives in terms of the kind of person you become when you focus on legalism, when you allow your orientation to God to be about law without the balance of grace. See, again, when I think that, again, it's law that dictates in my relationship with God, it's what I do for God rather than what God has done for me. And that's your orientation. What I can assure you of is, again, you will be external in your orientation. You will be prideful in your approach. You will be judgmental over those people that won't do that. And again, when it comes to human need, when it comes to human suffering, when it comes to caring for people, again, what Jesus is talking about in terms of the weightier aspects of the law. See, when Jesus talks about straining in a gnat, but swallowing a camel. Yeah, we're making sure that when we're walking down the street, our phylacteries are in place, our tassels and our robes are fine, but if a prostitute is walking on that side, I'm going to make sure I walk on this side and stay away from her. In all my self-righteousness and judgment, and I'm walking by and saying, thank you, God, that you didn't make me like her. See, that's the type of person that legalism produces. That's the way we become. And what Jesus is saying is that as he welcomes us to a grace-oriented living, where again, we don't forget law. Grace does not cancel the law, but it means that it's not the thing that is the primary dynamic between me and God. That what stands before me and God is grace. What stands before me and God is a means that God gives me to access his power, to be transformed by his being, so that now I can fulfill the law because I have those things. But see, when we're oriented in that way, and again, what is filling your heart is humility and not pride, now what happens? When we see human need, when we see someone that is struggling with life, what comes into play? Mercy, justice, faithfulness, in terms of the greater and more weightier matters of what God is trying to encourage. And what Jesus is saying to the Pharisees is, you missed it. You have corrupted not only yourself, but you've corrupted this nation. You've corrupted the people. And again, you need to be brought to task. Everyone in the temple in that day needs to hear, this is what Jesus the Messiah thinks about them. And remember, this is in the final week of Jesus' life. 4 days from now, he's going to be on a cross. But before that happens, now he's addressing, okay, these are the people who have taught you. These are the people that have come against me and are trying to fight against the influence and teaching that I've had have had towards you. And so before I leave, let me just make sure that I mark them as they should be. They're hypocrites. They're liars. They're prideful. They're leading people down a wrong way. And again, strong words that Jesus uses, but very necessary. Again, when we think about the kind of God God is, when we think about who Jesus is and what we conceive of him being, again, this is as consistent with him in terms of speaking these words as when he's speaking with the Samaritan woman and expressing the grace and the forgiveness there. Speaking to the prostitute who comes, and okay, who is it that judges you? Well, they've all gone. Well, you know something? I don't judge you either. But now go and sin no more. Again, whatever compassion, whatever love, whatever mercy we see in Jesus, that is what God